It's KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KOW. Thanks for tuning in today. In the late 1970s, David Neiwirth worked at a small daily newspaper in Sandpoint, Idaho, about 20 miles outside the Aryan Nation's compound, and he had to figure out how the paper was going to cover the hate group.
We thought, well, we'll do the smart thing. We'll ignore them. We'll pretend they're not there because they just want publicity, and that's what they want. And which is, I hear that a lot from people. Well, why don't you just ignore them? Maybe they'll go away. And the problem is that they take – it doesn't work. It has actually the opposite effect. They fester in darkness. They grow in darkness. They interpret the silence as tacit acceptance and tacit approval. So, yeah, within a couple of years of that decision, Northern Idaho was awash in a wave of crime and hate crimes. And that was when we realized, no, you have to shine a light on them. You know, don't just hold a little half candle with half knowledge. Reporters should be fully knowledgeable of what they're dealing with when they deal with these people, because then they can actually shine a very bright light on them. If you don't do it right, then it actually works to their favor as well. If you do a simple he said, she said approach to the story rather than explaining to your audience what these people actually stand for, then you're actually helping them.
Since those days in Idaho, David Neiwirth has not stopped studying and reporting on right-wing extremism in America, particularly here in the Northwest. His new book is called Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. He says online organizing has been a boon to white nationalism. It's largely what brought together the members of the alt-right, young white men who ground their grievances in identity politics.
They believe that Western civilization is under assault from a tide of brown people and feminists and social justice warriors, liberals, who they believe are degrading Western culture, and they want to combat it. There's a great deal of hatred of feminists and liberals and pretty much everybody else.
So that's who they hate. What do the alt-right want?
The alt-right, ultimately, especially its white nationalist component, really wants a white ethno-state in the United States, or at least a large portion of the United States, where whites and only whites can live.
And you've said that they see the Pacific Northwest as an ideal white ethno-state. Why is that?
Well, there's a long history of it here. Dates back, really, to the 60s and 70s when you had Klansmen talking about creating a white ethno-state, and some of them suggested the Pacific Northwest. And then one group of them from Southern California, the Aryan Nations, actually moved up here in the mid-70s and created a really significant presence here that we still really haven't recovered from.
I remember the Aryan Nations and the Skinheads and David Duke from decades ago. So what is so different now?
Well, there's a lot more of them. The big difference really is the internet. The internet has profoundly changed all of this. These people used to be really kind of geographically separated, spread out, and so they couldn't communicate with each other, couldn't organize, couldn't gain fresh recruits because they were really spread out all over the country. And the internet really erased that geographical distance and allowed these people to begin recruiting with each other. And the internet had a second effect, which was that, you know, you've probably noticed this in conversations and dialogues, especially with trolls, that dehumanization happens very easily on the internet because you're not really interacting with a human person. You're interacting with bits of information. And so one of the things that's very easy to happen is for people to start dehumanizing each other, to think of somebody they're even having a conversation with as just an object.
Do alt-right members actually expect literally a white ethno-state, or is this just a racist ideal they like to bond over?
Oh, I think they dream it. You know, it's a little bit more than just an idea to bond over. They have an actual strategy. You know, it's essentially an extension of the nativist strategy of self-deportation. Nativists have proposed for a long time that you get illegal immigrants to deport themselves by making conditions here so harsh and unpleasant for them that they just want to eventually remove themselves.
That's immigration, but what about, how does that lead to a white ethnostate?
Well, you'd create a white ethnostate by essentially resurrecting Jim Crow laws, enforcing them, depriving all minorities of any kind of civil rights or whatever other rights they might have. And
that means violence. So let's, right?
Yeah.
I mean, let's be explicit that we're talking about not just ideology, but an ideology whose only logical conclusion is violence.
It's ethnic cleansing.
Ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, yeah. That's ultimately where it leads. But they propose, of course, all kinds of legalistic means of getting there, all aimed towards getting, forcing people who are non-white to leave the region.
What is the most effective way to oppose the alt-right?
Well, they're fundamentally anti-democratic. Profoundly anti-democratic. They have nothing but open contempt for democracy and its institutions, including free speech, which is why you hear them complaining using free speech a lot. Their intention is to actually use the issue of free speech, one of the real institutions of a democracy, to beat it about the head and neck and actually help destroy it with. That's one of the things they talk amongst themselves. So when you I hear Milo Yiannopoulos campaigning for
this is the right-wing provocateur.
Yes, and the one who came here to University of Washington, he's an alt-right provocateur. And not just him, but a lot of these guys talk about, you know, free speech. And I know that it's just a cynical ploy on their part to gain a club to beat their enemies, that is liberal democracy, about the head and neck. And that's what they intend to do. I think you defeat it by employing the tools of liberal democracy, and particularly the vote. You know, you get people out to vote. One of the reasons that we've allowed them to get into power is that a lot of people don't get out there and vote. You know, less than half the country actually voted last year. That makes a big difference. I think people understand that politics does affect their lives and makes a difference in their lives, and they get out and vote. But
do you see evidence that Americans will vote against this authoritarianism?
There are more of us than there are of them.
Yeah.
And a lot more of us. And it's just a matter of getting people out of their chairs and into the voting booth in a lot of regards. And we just, you know, the problem is that people have become disconnected and cynical about politics. They don't feel that the government's working for them. I think we really need to revive the values of democracy, make it a, you know, democratic nation again.
So you don't think tiki torch marches should be violently opposed or punch a Nazi? You don't think that's effective?
No. I think that, you know, it's important to stand up to those people. They interpret silence as tacit approval. So simply ignoring them doesn't work. Pretending them away doesn't work. They have to be stood up to, but it can't be done violently, partly because they feed on that violence. That's what they do. You know, and not only that, I mean, the main thing they do is they dehumanize people. They demonize people. They turn people into just objects that, you know, yeah, it's okay to go punch. And you know what? I mean, yeah, I'll admit, Richard Spencer has the world's most punchable face, okay? But I don't recommend punching him because that's what he wants. And there's a reason he wants it, because he wants to use it as a club to defeat liberal democracy with.
So then outside of punching and ignoring, you're saying the ballot box, is that it? What's the most effective public resistance?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways you can publicly resist. I think that it is important to peacefully stand up to them. The most effective counter-protest I ever saw was in 2006 in Olympia, when the National Socialist Movement, which is a neo-Nazi organization, and they were based in Portland, they held a rally down on the Capitol steps in Olympia. And the crowd that came out to protest them that day was all dressed in clown outfits and Groucho masks, and they came out there in basically mooned those guys all day. It was hilarious and it was wonderful. It was actually the very best protest rally / thing I've ever attended.
You found it hilarious. Yeah. But how do you know it was effective?
Well, because that organization fell apart within a year. They were utterly humiliated. They sat up on the steps and just were red-faced and sputtered the entire afternoon. You could see that they felt humiliated. And like I say, yeah, within a year, that particular organization, it was based in Portland, pretty much fell apart.
I ask about the limits of hilarity because I grew up with Mel Brooks and, yeah, you know, et cetera, at a time of maybe less threat. But it might be easy for a couple of white guys like us, mm-hmm, to see the value in mockery but not feel as much at stake as someone who's targeted.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, obviously someone who's targeted, you know, they're not going to want to go out there and make fun unless they're in that mode. Obviously, it's a very serious subject. And making light of it isn't the purpose here. The purpose is to make them humiliated.
How high do you see the threat level, David? And again, I would not expect you to feel as personally threatened as somebody who's not a white man, mm-hmm, but you've studied this. We talked about neo-Nazis in the 70s, 80s, 90s. How severe is the threat level to you today?
I think we're in very dangerous territory, mainly because, you know, the right-wing extremists have never really held power in America, not to the extent that they do now. And if they have the opportunity to consolidate that power, then I think we're in very serious trouble because I think they do intend to impose an authoritarian rule. I think they do intend to do away with, you know, the power of the vote and the institutions of democracy. I think that the danger is very real. I think democracy is under siege, and I think people need to awaken to this. We've lived for basically 100 years under a very stable system, at least since the 1920s and 30s. And that liberal democracy is under siege now, and we can't take it for granted. We have to stand up and defend it if we really believe in it. I mean, if you believe in those values that I think most of us do, but we've taken them for granted. And these people want to destroy them.
Journalist David Neiwirth, what else do you want us to know, finally, about the radical right today?
Well, I think it's very important to understand authoritarianism and this rise, this tide of authoritarianism that is hitting us because – and to look at it squarely in the face. Authoritarianism is, you know, it has two major components. It has the followers and it has the leaders. We tend to focus on the leaders. We're all focused on Trump. And we tend to be fascinated with that. We're not paying any attention to the millions and millions of people out there who are the authoritarian followers because they're the actually important component in all this. And we need to understand the dynamic of how they think and how they act. Because I don't think we can do this systemically. I don't think there's a top-down solution. I think this has got to be bottom-up. I think it's got to come from all of us as ordinary citizens and people, that we have to stand up to this individually in our lives, in our families, around our Thanksgiving dinner tables, talking about this stuff in a real way, in a way that actually makes a difference.